extreme bit, on extreme bit in the woodlands.
Yeah. We won't see it. Good morning. A very warm welcome to everyone here. As my colleague said, we're looking forward to a very lively day, given the topic at hand and the individuals here as well. We're going to be kicking off the day with a session on security and defense. And knowing these four distinguished gentlemen as I do, I know that we can look forward to a very spirited session for sure. Now, I'm going to introduce them in a moment, but first let me say a few words about set the stage for this panel. Sitting in Washington, D.C., one of the things that I hear often is a question about for Indian foreign policy these days, and that question is, what is India really thinking? What does India really want? And for many outsiders, I think what comes out of Delhi often is ambiguity and mixed signals. But I don't think this should be entirely surprising. First of all, India is a tumultuous democracy. And secondly, I think India's rise toward a major power has been extremely rapid and to an extent unexpected. We might recall that in Paul Kennedy's classic book, The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers, written just 25 years ago, India was barely mentioned. Yet the country has now catapulted to a position where many people talk about India and China in the same breath. India is clearly in a moment of transition. And whereas the country, you know, had a fairly strong foreign policy consensus for nearly 50 years after independence, over the last several years, what we see is policy being much more contested in India. Now, in your folder, you will find a handout on Indian foreign policy perspective. That is, it's adapted from our chapter that I have written with my co-author, Rajesh Rajagopalan, who's a professor at Jawaharlal Nehru University. And it will be in our forthcoming book. The chart lays out what we see are the main foreign policy schools of thought in India, what the primary goals are, and what the preferred foreign policy instruments are. And just to give you a quick snapshot, we identify three big categories. We call them the nationalists, the realists, and the globalists. Now, let me hasten to say that in the Indian case, there's actually quite a bit of overlap between these schools. And often, I think it's these overlap that most of the analysts tend to focus on. But I would argue that the most interesting aspect is, in fact, the emerging differences of opinion on foreign policy. And I guess as academics, it's our job to look for patterns and make generalizations from a range of opinions that we see and try to systematically present them, hopefully making it easier to think about Indian foreign policy trends and implications and make it useful beyond academia. At least that's what we have tried to do in this project. Okay, let me just say a few words to quickly introduce these Indian perspectives. First, we divide the nationalist school into three subdivisions. What we call the standard nationalist, which is a sort of long-standing centrist group, historically making up the bulk of the Congress Party. To a great extent, I think the other schools, the other national schools are all breakaway, the other schools are all breakaway or offshoots of this centrist tendency. The other nationalist school is what we call the neo-nationalist school, and we see this group gaining voice after the 1991 economic liberalization as critics of India's new path and urging really continued focus on domestic priorities. And the third one is the hyper-nationalist school, which became vocal mostly after the 1998 nuclear test, promoting a more ambitious military posture and a truly international scope to India's foreign policy. So apart from the first nationalist category, our second major category is what we call the Great Power Realist School. And these are all terms that Rajesh and I have coined. So you won't find them in the in other sort of literature, so to speak. Great Power Realist we see as emerging after 1998 also, but the emphasis here would be on India engaging with other major powers, and particularly on the global stage, and becoming a proactive political global player. And finally, there's the liberal globalist school, which is also a post-1991, post-liberalization outgrowth, one that embraces globalization and economic integration and the continuing economic reforms. Now, let me emphasize that I'm not, it was not our intention to put labels on any individual or individuals, but to try and capture the various strands of foreign policy opinion that has emerged in India. As I said, the opinions may spill over between the schools, but we think there are important divergences that will be lost if we don't do this kind of differentiation. Indeed, you are likely to hear some of these different schools of thought reflected in our panelists' comments. I think it's safe to say that the individuals here represent a fairly wide range of opinion. They may or may not agree with the way we've characterized the different Indian schools of thought, and I think, you know, I'm sure there's, we will hear some criticism, but you and the audience can draw your own conclusions about where our panelists might fall in terms of our schools of thought. If you look really carefully, maybe you can see some kind of resemblance between the seating arrangement and the chart, but I'll leave that up to you. All right, now it's my pleasure to introduce our panelists. And again, I want to thank them for having traveled all the way from India. I know how extremely busy they are. We've worked very hard to accommodate everybody's schedules, and I'm just glad to see that they arrived here despite the sleet, the snow, and unexpected weather patterns and so forth. I'm truly, truly grateful to them. Now, as Henry said, their extensive bios are all in your folder, so I won't repeat that to save time. So let me just begin by starting with my, to my extreme left, no pun intended, is Manishankar Iyer, a highly active member of parliament who has just finished a particularly combative parliamentary session in India, given the anti-corruption bill that was being debated. Next to him is T.N. Nainan, one of India's best-known business media personalities and commentators. And to my immediate right is Lalit Man Singh. Many of you may know him from his illustrious run as India's ambassador to the U.S., who went on to take up the key post of India's foreign secretary. And then to my extreme right is Bharat Karnad, one of the country's most prolific, respected, and vocal commentators on India's security issues. Now, before we begin, a quick word on the format. These sessions are not going to be the usual series of presentations of papers or commentary followed by Q&A. Rather, what we did is we designed it so that it's going to be a dialogue. With the moderators posing some questions to the panel, and then having the speakers engage in a conversation with the moderator and engaging with each other as well. And to do this efficiently, I'm going to ask the speakers to not go over 2 to 3 minutes in response to your questions. I don't have any kind of a bell or anything, but I did, someone gave me a clock with the numbers wide here, so we can actually follow that. So I will have to, I hope you won't mind if I have to cut you short or interrupt you unceremoniously, but I will try and hopefully I'll just ask that you try to keep it to that time. You can always elaborate or follow up on the questions, because there will be several rounds of questioning. But of course, feel free to disagree with each other, since that's one of our aims, is to draw out the differences between the various perspectives. And so with that, let me now start with a basic question on India's security and defense. That's what this session is going to focus on. We'll have other sessions on the economics and transnational questions later. And as I said, we probably will not have time for audience questions at this point because it is a packed session, but you will have the opportunity in the afternoon. So let me start with India's threat environment. And I want to ask the panelists what they see as the main threats to India's security. Do they see them as being at the immediate regional, that is at the South Asia level, at a broader Asian level, or global? For example, with the Middle East conflicts and controversies flying around. And moreover, how would you prioritize those threats that India faces? So let me begin, and again, 2 to 3 minutes, please. Let me start with my colleague, Manishankar Iyer, and we'll just go down.
I think the biggest threat to our national security is ourselves. If we continue to live with the illusion that we are a global power or aspire to be a global power, then we will be endangering ourselves. But if we stick to our traditional concept of what foreign policy is about, which is eschewing the quest for dominance and seeking, using diplomacy as the instrument of promoting peaceful coexistence, then all threats to us get diminished. And in this context, I would say that our single highest priority ought to be the relationship with Pakistan. And I believe that a number of developments, not only in the recent past, but looking back over the last 65 years, would appear to indicate that if we seize the opportunity being presented to us at the moment, it should be possible for us to defuse the tension with Pakistan and thereby remove what most Indians would agree would appear to be the single most imminent threat to India. And in this regard, I think the India-Pakistan relationship should in some ways follow the pattern of the India-China relationship as established by Rajiv Gandhi since December 1988, which is to assert your own point of view, but not allow it to spill over into tensions or any disruption of tranquility at the borders. And what we have experienced with China over the last 23 years is, I think, the path to go down with Pakistan with respect to issues that might continue to divide us, but all the time looking for opportunities which would bring us together. And this does mean that instead of aspiring to be a global power, which I think would be ridiculous for an India of today to do, since 80% of our people have a consumption capacity of less than 50 cents a day at the exchange rate and less than $2 a day at purchasing power parity, for us to pretend that we are a global power or even aspire to be one until the people of India have been included in the growth process, which at present is involving only a small segment of our population, would be to make the Wilhelmine mistake, to start thinking of ourselves as a global power when we are not one, to make the Tojo mistake of thinking that we are a global power when we are not one, and to abandon principles on which we won our independence in favor of becoming a, inverted commas, responsible player on the international scene. We are often asked whether we are fit to be a member of the United Nations Security Council and by being ready to take on our responsibilities. If taking on responsibilities means invading Afghanistan, invading Iraq, threatening to invade Iran, then I'm glad that we do not have any responsibility in India, and I hope we never will have a sense of responsibility towards such a United Nations. We have to work towards a more democratic world order, and that does mean that people stop aspiring to become a global power and instead start aspiring towards a form of international cooperation, which I think is best set out in the punch sheet, the 5 principles of peaceful coexistence that were evolved between India and China over the Tibet dispute.
Mani, could I just ask you to clarify one point? So is Pakistan the only threat that you see to India?
Well, both Pakistan and China are nuclear weapon armed powers. Both of them have long borders with India. And with both of them, we have many disputes. And therefore, it is important that we defuse that in the first instance. Otherwise, we carry Pakistan in particular as the albatross around our necks, and possibly a second albatross in the shape of the Chinese. And with the Chinese being a power which has arms that extend well into the Indian Ocean, and with confrontational relationships with other countries in the world, I think the last thing India would want to do, or should want to do, is to get involved in other people's rivalries with China, and instead to try to see whether we cannot be good neighbors with China.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to allow Nainan to go next, but I do want to ask you one thing. If you could please actually tell us what the threats are, because we will have lots of opportunity to come back to the UN Security Council, major power status, and so forth. So if you could, Nainan, when you answer this, just tell us what you think are the major threats and how you would prioritize them. Do you agree that Pakistan is the major threat? Or?
Thank you very much. Good morning, everybody. Thank you, Deepa. I actually agree with a lot of what Mani has said, though I would sort of say it differently. Major threats, to answer your question, that I would mention, and then I'll come to India and China, to Pakistan and China, are one, the environment, and two, energy. And both flow from the fact that India's, I think, primary concern is to make sure that it has the room to grow economically. We are still a country with per capita income that is barely $1,500. We fall into the lower middle income category in the World Bank classification. The global average for humanity is $9,000. So we are less than 20% of the global average on per capita incomes. So there is a long way to go before you can even get to being a middle income, a proper middle income country. And to do that, you need the space in terms of both energy and the environment. We are principally a large energy importer, and there is clear security threat if you don't get your energy supplies from overseas, and there are some scenarios where supplies could be disrupted. The second is, of course, the whole climate issue, where you, in one of your papers that you sent us, you talked about India being a free rider, and I would think it's the rich countries that have been the free riders environmentally, and that is might impinge on our ability to create the space for growth. So I think the challenges, the security challenges to India's growth are these two, and they will both be with us for a long time. They won't go away very easily, so we need to work towards solutions for those two. I think let me stay away from China and Pakistan, and then we have sure opportunity to come back to them later. My perspectives are broadly what Mani said, but slightly different.
Okay, we will come back to China and Pakistan, but let me turn to Lasman Singh and see if he agrees or he has a different set of threats that he thinks India faces. And we will come back and talk about how we might actually face them, what instruments to use and so forth, but if you could just...
Thank you, Deepa. I want to make it clear that I don't quite agree with your classifications, because when I saw them, I was a bit puzzled. I didn't find myself in any of the categories. So my basic...
You're hiding back there.
I think we are all nationalists in all this panel. We probably speak from the same page. We have differences on approach and nuances, but I don't think these are fundamental ideological differences. On the threat perception, I leave out the global threats like climate change and energy issues and so on. Let me focus on the immediate threats. And here, it's not what Mani said, it's not a question of dominance. It's a question of our right to exist as a nation, as large as we are. And we need to find our place within our region. And we need at least 10 years of uninterrupted growth at 9 to 10% in order to deal with our domestic, primary domestic issue, which is poverty. But there are countries which are threatening this path of growth, and we have to look at how we are feeling threatened by them. The immediate threats of the military kind are from only two countries, China and Pakistan. China has 4,000 kilometers of disputed border with India, and you have the world's two largest armies facing each other across this border. The Chinese have not shown any particular desire to resolve this issue, because out of 14 of the neighbors, they have signed border agreements with 12 of them, leaving out India and Bhutan. So it's basically India. And it's not only the threat we perceive from the north across the border, now the Chinese are increasing their presence in the south, in our maritime zone, and coming closer and closer and establishing naval facilities in our neighborhood. It's a source of concern. I'm not saying that there's any imminent threat of attack from China, but it's a concern. And then there is Pakistan. With Pakistan, we've had a troubled relationship right from the time of independence. And out of the 5 wars that India has fought in the last 65 years, 4 have been initiated by Pakistan. Pakistan threatens India at the conventional level, at the subconventional level, which is through terrorism, and at the nuclear level. We can discuss that later on when we discuss Pakistan. But this is basically the threat perception we have. And we need to face it not by mere discussions, because we have been having a dialogue with both China and Pakistan for all these years, for 65 years. We haven't come to any particular understanding. And therefore, many of us have come to the conclusion that India needs strength. Domestic strength, it has to be strong economically, politically, militarily. And then discuss with countries like China and Pakistan from a position of strength. It is not that India is threatening anybody, but India has a right to protect its interests. And this is the basis of our foreign policy. I think I'll leave it there, and maybe you can discuss later.
Okay.
We just heard great power ambitions of India described as illusory. I think it's equally delusional to believe that India is faced with no threat, meaning military threat. And I do think that if I were to prioritize the threats, 3 threats that India does face in a material and substantive way, it is China first. Number 2, the proliferation policies of China. And number 3, terrorism from Pakistan. Terrorism, independent of Pakistani state, because I think it was, fostered by the United States during the Soviet occupation. Thereafter, the Pakistanis took over and nursemaiding this particular threat. It has grown into a Frankensteinian monster. And it's, I think, gone beyond control of the Pakistan army right now. So it's terrorism based in Pakistan as a third threat.
Okay. Now, I think we've heard two different views on Pakistan and what the major threats are. So could I ask generally to what extent you think terrorism, which 3 of you did not mention, but only Bharat did, whether you, any of you agree with that or not. And let me ask Mani, since you're the one who said that Pakistani did not see it as a threat.
Terrorism is a threat to our domestic peace in an episodic manner. It's hardly a threat to the nation's security as a whole, because the worst terrorist incident took place over a period of 2 or 3 days in Mumbai. Most other terrorist incidents take place in 1 or 2 blasts at 1 or 2 places. And we've got a lot of terrorism going which is domestic rather than international, in the sense that in the forest areas of central India, we have what some perceive as the Maoist threat and others perceive as the Maoist solution. We've also had problems in the past with the Khalistanis in Punjab. And therefore we have, and of course in the northeast of India, there's been a lot of trouble for a very long time, much of which continues. So the terrorism from Pakistan is definitely a problem. It's certainly a problem when it comes to its being either state-sponsored or quasi-state-sponsored. But I do believe that to the extent to which it is state or quasi-state-sponsored, the best answer for India lies in establishing a cooperative relationship with Pakistan in investigating these terrorist incidents as well as tracking down who are the people responsible. Because one of the major changes that I think has occurred in Pakistan in recent years is the discovery that the most terrorist-threatened country in the world is Pakistan. They're losing far more thousands to terrorism within Pakistan than they're causing outside of Pakistan. And the three sects of terrorist groups inside Pakistan, those who are fundamentally anti-West, those who are fundamentally anti-Indian, and those who are fundamentally anti-Pakistan, are all coming together and drawing their financial and arms resources from approximately the same sources. So I think there is a dawning recognition in Pakistan that there can be no such thing as an isolated anti-Indian terrorist network. It's linked in with those who are against the Pakistan state too. And therefore there is an atmosphere in Pakistan which I think we could avail of in order to promote India-Pakistan cooperation in chasing the terrorists. And the most hopeful signs recently are the decision of Pakistan to send their judicial commission to India as part of the investigation of the terrorist attack that took place on 26/11 in Mumbai, as also the continued activity of the anti-terrorist court, which is a special fast-track court in Pakistan. But recognizing always that both our systems are not geared towards justice, they are geared towards stay orders. And just as any case in India takes decades to come to a conclusion, so also is Pakistan infected with exactly the same disease.
Okay, thank you. Would Naina or Mr. Mansi, you want to weigh in on the terrorism threat? Is that?
Yeah. I think Mani is right when he described these terrorist groups based in Pakistan. I don't think he's right in just dismissing them as episodic. It's episodic if you regard 9/11 as episodic. 60,000 people have lost their lives to terrorists in India. It's a serious issue. And these groups based in Pakistan continue to receive the support of the Pakistani authorities. Their leaders go scot-free. They give public speeches, hate speeches, asking their followers to attack India, destroy India. So it is a serious threat. And mind you, they started off as anti-India terrorist outfits. Then they joined the International Islamic Front of Osama bin Laden. They have become, in a way, franchisees of Al-Qaeda. And as you saw during the 26/11 attack in Mumbai, they were not asking for liberation of Kashmir. They were attacking Americans, Israelis, foreigners who had come. This is the jihadi agenda of these groups, and they haven't stopped functioning. Now, I think we should discuss with Pakistan, but our frustration is that you discuss with Pakistan and then you don't get any results. Imagine the fourth year after 26/11. We have completed the trials. The man we nabbed during the terrorist attacks has been sentenced to death. Pakistan has not even begun the process of the trials. We ask for voice samples because we have voice samples of people who are communicating with the terrorists. The Pakistani authorities say, we cannot give you the voice samples. Our law doesn't allow it. So what are we looking at? What kind of cooperation are we getting? This is the frustration of dealing with terrorism that is actually being sponsored, promoted, funded by groups within Pakistan. And the Pakistani state says, we're helpless. These are non-state actors. But this is unacceptable to us. Domestic terrorism, yes, this is serious. But this is something that can be contained because it's an issue of governance. It's a lack of governance that has spawned the Maoist movement in India. And it is time that serious attention was given to it. The government can't continue to deal with it as a law and order situation. There's something more basic in the Maoist movement which needs to be addressed. Thank you.
Yeah, let me turn to something that's connected to the Pakistan region, that is the Afghanistan question that is actually looming in front of all of us, including India. And I'd like to know, to what extent do you think, the panelists think that the US policy or NATO policy in Afghanistan is a threat to India? Anybody would like to?
If I may, I think the principal threat that comes is from Afghanistan is that when the US gets involved in Afghanistan, it tends to wink at all Pakistan's sins. And so the Pakistanis then feel encouraged to turn up the ante against India. You saw this in the first phase when the Russians had moved into Afghanistan, and the US is therefore willing to wink at Pakistan going nuclear because they needed Pakistani help. And this time when they've come in again, chasing bin Laden and the Taliban, they've actually winked at a great deal of terrorist activity sponsored from Pakistan because the US didn't feel it could annoy Pakistan beyond a point because it needed the supply lines. So I think US perception of dependence on Pakistan actually encourages Pakistan, and that's really the primary Afghan issue. But I want to come back to the previous discussion and make a brief point, which is that we can deal with Pakistani-sponsored terrorism, and we should be able to deal with it. Where we have failed to deal with it is because of significant domestic failures of our internal security system. They were laid bare both in the attack on Parliament and in the attack on Mumbai. And I'm not sure that even today we have a system that is as good as it should be. I think the real danger is that if you deal with it in a manner that creates a ground for domestic terrorism, which I think Mani, if I'm not mistaken, mentioned, and you need to be absolutely sure that you don't create a domestic bed for terrorism, that I think is the far more serious long-term issue that Indian government and society should be focused on. As for the Maoists, my assessment is that actually the situation has turned. After 20 years, if not more, of the Maoists steadily gaining ground, of spreading their influence, covering more districts and more states, I think in the last year or two, we've actually seen the heat being turned on the Maoists. They're on the defensive, they're not spreading out, they're able to do less and less. You could now lead from that into the kind of things that Lalit said, where you know you don't just show a gun to people in the tribal areas, you show them something else as well in terms of development. Thank you.
Okay, anything on that?
Yeah, Deepa, I'm glad you raised Afghanistan. The US NATO policy is not a threat to India, but the absence of a US NATO policy is definitely seen as a threat. Because we're a bit bewildered about what kind of policy is being pursued. After the Bonn conference, which brought in the change of regime in Afghanistan, India was told to keep away from most issues, anything related to security, India was not supposed to touch. And then when President Obama came to India, he was urging India to do more and get more involved in Afghanistan. So Washington's signals are a bit confusing to us. We would like a more coherent policy, but definitely, what NATO and the United States are doing in Afghanistan to control the elements that can bring about stability in the region is seen as a positive from our point of view.
Can I just say?
Well, coherence would be a first.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah,
sure.
I think we understand that the basic thrust of American policy is to, I think in a sense, declare victory and get the hell out. That's a great thing when you're on the losing wicket. The problem here is that having created a problem insofar as first getting the Taliban out after 26/11 and then now in a sense negotiating with Taliban to get out yourselves, you have created a situation wherein anything can happen. And one of the things that can happen is that if the Mullah Omar team in Kabul does take over the government of Afghanistan, and if the US is negotiating a withdrawal with the good Taliban, as Robert Gates talked about it, then I think the US must make sure that the links between the Afghan Taliban is severed as far as the Pakistan Taliban are concerned, and the other outfits connected with the Pakistan Taliban, like the various Lashkars that are targeting India. So there are follow-on kind of steps or measures that will need to be taken by somebody. And if the US is keen to get out, no matter what the cost to the region, that seems generally to be the American posture anyway, then I think we'll be saddled with the problems. I mean, and try to resolve them.
Okay, that...
May I come in on this?
Yes. A quick one. We need to actually, there are many more questions I have for you, so...
Okay, then
We'll come back to Afghanistan. If it's Afghanistan, okay. I'll come right back to it. Because what I'd like to now do is to turn to how India might respond to some of these threats, what the instruments of foreign policy might be that you would recommend in dealing with the threats, coping with the threats, whether we agree with what the priorities are or not. So if I could ask by, for instance, on Afghanistan itself, one could ask the question, if the US withdraws, or if there is continued to be a muddled sort of policy, what should India's policy be? Some people say that India sort of outsourced its foreign policy on Afghanistan to the US and NATO, and that is sitting back. And others say that now the Indians should take a much more proactive policy. So there are a number of different issues that come up then. Should India be more activist or not? Brings into question also another thing I wanted to ask, and that is, should India be relying on security allies? Is it time for India to think about, with something that India has been rather allergic to, if not just partnership, but really moving towards some more robust alliances to deal with the threats? So let's see, where do we start here this time?
Yes, I think, as I said, in the context of China as the main threat and singular threat, not just to India, but most of the countries on its periphery, and perhaps in the United States, there will have to be, I've talked about something called organic security architecture, organic to the region. The United States is important in that it's always been an offshore balancer. The question is whether it can continue to be that, play that role. And if it does, then there's always, that's a positive element, because it's slightly reassuring to have the American military presence, etc. But to over-rely on the United States to a point where one can expect the United States to come in on the side of countries facing China in Asia, I think would be a mistake. So India does need to have very strong security and military relationships, with starting with an architecture wherein you have it's anchored on two sides in Israel and Japan, the Southeast Asian countries, especially Vietnam, in a sense being the soft underbelly, Southeast Asia, of China, and you begin to have a very strong relationship really with Vietnam in particular, and use Vietnam, as China has, in a sense, used Pakistan vis-a-vis India. And this may be a bit controversial, but considering that China invariably has had no scruples where non-proliferation matters are concerned, where in fact it has proliferated deliberately, I would think that India has been pushed to a point where the government would have to very seriously consider whether or not to respond in kind. Now, I've been saying for 20 odd years that we really need to pay back the Chinese in their own coin, and the payback in terms of nuclear missile arming Vietnam. We should do that, because I've been in enough second tracks with Chinese to understand that that is the sort of language they really, and I do not mean to trivialize this or overstate it, but because they are into real, hard realpolitik, this is a sort of measure that will get their attention and stop them from behaving in the way they have been doing in the last 30 odd years.
Okay, to continue with this question, let me ask, so in a sense, rather than going it alone, I mean, there are different options that India has in terms of dealing with the threats. One is to go it alone, another is to come up with some sort of security architecture, another is pure diplomacy of some sort and go back to sort of its traditional mores. So how would you
characterize it? Deepa, you raised two issues. How does India respond to the threats in general? I think three things need to be done. One, a better definition of security. It is emerging. We are clearer about our security parameter, our immediate neighborhood, extended neighborhood, and so on. Second, we need to strengthen armed forces because they have been neglected for a very long time, and it's time to bring them up to par. Third is we need proactive diplomacy. But in terms of the suggestion you made about whether we need security allies, I don't think we need security allies. We need partners. And this is an important distinction. We will never go in for alliances. We will always stop at partnerships. And these partnerships are important. Just because we have a strategic partnership with the US doesn't mean that it is a US-only partnership. And that's sometimes Washington misses the point when they feel that now that we have a strategic partnership, we expect India to behave in a particular way. Those of you who know India knows that India values its strategic autonomy. And so an alliance is out of the question, but we do have strategic partnerships with a dozen odd countries. And these constitute some old friends like Russia, Germany, France, Britain, some new friends like Australia, Japan, Brazil, South Africa, and even old adversaries, and I put the United States in that category. But this is basically the security architecture that is merging. And we are following two tracks. One is the open track of military relationships, joint military exercises, which are going on. And the other is a more tacit understanding, in the sense that we are exchanging notes, we are carrying out a dialogue, we are looking at China and wondering which way China is going. And in case China becomes unpredictable or belligerent or aggressive, then we would have to act together and meet that threat. So I think we are going the right tracks. Thanks.
Can I suggest that you are now roughly midway through this session, and you know, I think you're in danger of the story. The thing about if you're a hammer, then everything that you see is a nail. And you're describing security and foreign policy in terms of what diplomats do or think tank people do. And I think you're making a serious mistake in straitjacketing the discussion into these specific silos instead of looking at the much broader issues. You know, if you were to look at energy, that would influence your policy vis-a-vis West Asia. You want to keep the lanes of supply open. You want to have pipelines. You want to build access into Central Asia. These will fundamentally determine the way you want to deal with Iran or Afghanistan or a whole series of other issues. And to completely ignore that and go on about whether you will step into America's shoes or something else is really to be completely blind to what your real interests are. Similarly, to ignore the environmental question, when India will be one of the front-running countries to get affected by global warming if and when it happens.
We actually, in the second session, we actually will be dealing with that.
Okay, so
you will have time to deal with that. Yeah, no,
teams.
I agree. It will be definitely brought into question on the second session, economics and other climate issues and so forth. But thank you for bringing it, because actually we will come back to the energy security in this session, because it is relevant to the Iran question and the threats in West Asia for India. Anything that, Manshankari, would you like to add anything to that?
Yep. God forbid that we get ourselves into alliances, and God further forbid that we get entangled in other people's alliances. I think it's absolutely essential that we stick to our principle of non-alignment, which essentially means not getting involved in other people's military adventures or even other people's diplomatic adventures. I think what happened in Afghanistan is illustrative of the importance of our keeping away, as indeed what happened in Iraq is illustrative of what we should be doing in keeping away. For into Afghanistan went the Americans after having ignored them throughout the period of the Taliban rule, which was in many ways the only time when we need to have been seriously concerned, because India has the enormous advantage pointed out by Chanakya, our Machiavelli, about 2000 years ago, that it's your neighbor who's your enemy and your neighbor's neighbor who's your friend. And as someone who's visited Afghanistan more than once, I get very embarrassed, A, at the way in which they love India, and B, at the way in which they hate Pakistan. So for us, basically, there is a civilizational connection to Afghanistan, which is entirely weighted in our favor. Now, that Afghanistan is the Afghanistan that existed before the Americans went in, and an Afghanistan that will continue to be after the Americans go out. And therefore, it's an Afghanistan in which there are very, very strong conservative Islamist features and advocates. And the Taliban is woven in its value system into the warp and the woof of what most of rural Afghanistan believes. Now, all these things are capable of evolution and change, but not as a result of its being imposed on from outside. And therefore, the kind of solution, I regretted the Americans coming into Afghanistan, and I welcome the prospect of their going away. But there obviously has to be an end game, and that end game is one that should principally be played by the Afghans themselves, which means, in some ways, looking towards what happened in Laos in 1962. Of course, that was a solution that did not endure, but nevertheless set an example of first the domestic parties getting together, perhaps in a big jirga, and deciding among themselves what is the nature of the sharing of power and what is the kind of future that they look to for themselves. And then to attempt to come to an agreement among the peripheral powers involved, starting with Pakistan, Afghanistan, Tajikistan, who are the closest to Afghanistan, and then spreading perhaps to countries like India, where we agree among ourselves to allow the domestic settlement to actually work itself out instead of interfering or allowing our soil to be used to interfere there. And then finally, the third circle of these three concentric circles, which would be the international community, agreeing to more or less guarantee that at least they won't interfere in the internal equilibria that get established and get evolved as Afghanistan goes forward. For our interest in Afghanistan is not, cannot and should not be military. It's fundamentally one of working together with them. And perhaps the reason why India enjoys such a high reputation in Afghanistan is that all that we have done in Afghanistan over the last few years has been designed to assist the Afghans without necessarily benefiting India. All the cooperation is of a developmental nature. And I, as Minister of Local Government, was involved with working with the ministries and departments of local government in Afghanistan to try and help them. And I think in many ways, the best results that have been obtained are those that have been obtained absolutely at the grassroots level by mobilizing communities themselves. And I've seen with my own eyes how they hold different village assembly meetings for the men and the women, but the subjects are the same. And eventually, what the women say have to be taken into consideration by the men as well before they proceed with implementation. So they have their own way of doing things, and I think we should respect those ways of doing things. I'm not unhappy at all at the prospect that the Americans may be leaving that area. I think we have to leave it to them to work it out. There are other issues that have been raised, but I thought I should have my Afghanistan point now, and I come to other things.
Just a very quick question I want to ask related to that is, do any of you place much faith in the in a non-Western organization like Shanghai Cooperation Organization as being particularly important for India in security?
Yeah, the SCO is essentially Chinese front organization. I mean, I think the Russians are been pretty sidelined there. And I think the balanced correlation of forces in SCL simply do not take into account India's interests. In fact, the Chinese have been, as you're perhaps aware, vetoing or coming in even as observers. So let's at least be clear what SCL is about.
Okay, and before I turn to some questions on the trade-off between defense budget and the economics in India, which I think Nayar might have something to talk about, I can't leave this particular topic until I ask a rather pointed question, and that is, should India pursue a balance of power policy toward China? Do you see it necessary for India to respond to the so-called pearl necklace strategy or not? Is it a string of pearls strategy or not? And let me, let's start with the, if I can ask you.
Should India pursue a balance of power policy? There's no question of pursuing a balance of power policy. As our Prime Minister has often said, the world is large enough for both countries to grow and prosper. So why should we compete with each other and balance each other? That's not required. But the Chinese have a policy, and it's clearly emerging as a kind of method by which they not only promote their economic interests, they are actually trying to keep India boxed in within the South Asian context. And this is where we have to respond to their so-called string of pearls. It's not that they have done anything wrong in having agreements to build naval facilities in our neighborhood. I think we should have done that. The Chinese are smarter, they did it first. But having said that, there is an increasing Chinese military presence in the Indian Ocean area. And they are talking dangerously in terms of protecting their own sea lanes of commerce. And that is not acceptable. Any encroachment on the global commons is not acceptable. And we have to be proactive in getting all other countries together to oppose this kind of thing. Does India have an answer to the string of pearls? I think we have what is called the necklace of diamonds. We are building up our bilateral military relationships with key countries in the Indian Ocean area, with Australia, with Indonesia, with Vietnam, with our neighboring countries in South Asia, with Gulf Cooperation Council countries. That's how we want to do it, to make sure that everybody is aware that the Indian Ocean has to be kept open for everybody, and nobody, no power, has the right to encroach on the global commons.
But what is the element of military power in this?
We have to have a blue water navy, because we have to walk the talk. If you're asking other countries to be alert and protect our common interests, we should be able to contribute. That's why it's important to have a better navy.
Okay, Nainan, would you agree that a diamond necklace and a blue water navy should be the proper response?
These are catchwords. You have to recognize that in or about 2020, the number of hulls which the Navy has or will have will not be any different than the number that existed in the 1980s. Each particular ship, ship to ship when you compare, would of course be a better fighting machine, but the size of the Navy per se would not have expanded for more than 30 years. So the fact is that we have neglected our Navy. You have started ramping up to expand size, but a serious blue water Navy is a long way off. And I don't think even by 2030, you will seriously have a blue water Navy. What you are having in response to the string of pearls business is that you are reaching out, as it said, to countries in the Chinese littoral area. And the fact also is that all of them are busy rearming. Indonesia has developed a third naval base within its own territory. The US is now setting up in Darwin. South Korea has set up a new naval base, which is clearly directed at China. Vietnam is rearming. Every country in the region sees a threat and is responding. I think India is doing the same. So I frankly feel that this great threat that you see from the Chinese Navy is not serious prospect for a long time to come. Its Navy is fundamentally still a coastal force. It's trying to reach out, but its primary targets are going to be elsewhere, not in the Indian Ocean. I think they have a legitimate interest in wanting to keep their energy supplies open from West Asia all the way through. That doesn't mean they will close sea lanes, and they will never be in a position to close the sea lanes in this part. So let's recognize that they will be a force, and we will be a force.
Well, vis-a-vis China, should...
Can I come in on this?
Okay. Very quickly.
I find myself blindsided by the more bulky Nainan over here. So I have to remind you that I think the point needs to be underlined, which was mentioned in passing by Nainan, that the Chinese have a legitimate interest in keeping sea lanes open for their energy resources from West Asia, just as we have. And I don't think it's in anybody's interest that these lanes should be in any way disrupted. And therefore, there is a cooperative angle to this, apart from a confrontational angle to this. Secondly, I think we need to recognize that we have a legitimate interest in protecting our own defense, but that this is a right that is exercised by every sovereign country, and they're going to be doing it. So instead of going back to completely discredited 19th century doctrines like the balance of power, the breakdown of which was responsible for the massacres that took place in the 20th century, instead of invoking all this in the 21st century, we ought to be looking for cooperative solutions and not for confrontational solutions. And in this context, yes, for us to have a strong navy to defend ourselves in the event of an attack on us is completely legitimate. But if we are seeking to have a blue water navy in order to take on the Chinese in the vicinity of Diego Garcia, then I think this is precisely the kind of aspiration to global power which must be completely discouraged in the case of India. We should be working towards a cooperative relationship. And I know that appeasement has become a very bad word since Adolf Hitler, but I do believe that Adolf Hitler was something of an exception to the normal run of humanity. I think the confrontation that took place in 1962, the military confrontation, owed a great deal to our departing from our own principles in India, and that was a wholly unnecessary war from which the occupied territories, which China still continues to claim, they deliberately withdrew their forces from there. And although they continue to press their claims, there has not been a serious military effort to enforce those claims. And in these circumstances, I think the answer we found in these peace and tranquility talks on the border between the National Security Advisor in India, who is becoming increasingly a very, very powerful voice, and the Chinese counterpart, are a very useful way of protecting our security, far more useful than trying to project ourselves towards Darwin or somewhere. Let's remain within our territory, and insofar as the Chinese have a presence elsewhere, I think we also need to tell ourselves that when offers were made to us to join hands with them, we declined it, and therefore we have only ourselves to blame if the Chinese have a splendid port available to them in Sri Lanka. I think we come back all the time to a fundamental question. Are you looking for a balance of military power in order to ensure your peace and security? Or are you trying to use diplomacy, not as war by other means, but as a technique of preventing war under any circumstances?
May I just say on this? I think we should discuss the hard aspects of military power. If you give credence to money, you can rely entirely on diplomacy, all soft power, without having the hard power to back it up. Well, good luck if you can manage it. We have tried to and haven't succeeded very well. The hardline aspects of military power is this. By 2030, India will have a navy with 130 ships. I think the new water aspects are best described by what they call the tanker to capital ship ratio, and the approaching and the ratio of 1:5 by that time, which is actually the US Navy standard. We'll reach it by 2030. So you essentially have ships that have very long legs. I don't know where what Nainan knows about this or doesn't, but the question is, you have substantively the material now for blue water approach, assuming you go ahead and implement it. Now, one of the troubles is after 2611, the entire Western fleet has been tasked, and this is a great problem in the Navy, by the government and some people within the Navy itself, to being a coastal police as well. And there's actually a Coast Guard. So, you know, you end up handicapping yourselves in this way. And finally, on the string of pearls and all this, the Chinese are actually only brown water. Let's be very honest of what the Chinese Navy is. They might have some vessels here and there that have some things on board, but they are not blue water in any sense of the word. They do not have traditions. Maybe the great Admiral Zhang Ruo in previous times might have reached a certain acme of performance, naval performance, but since then it's been virtually zero. The carrier that they're going to bring in will take about 30 years to be integrated into fleet operations. If they come in any kind of forceful way, west of Malacca, assume they can get past the Indian Naval Command and Eastern Naval Command coordinated activity, you can wish for it. It's not going to be easy even for the Chinese. And finally, the string of pearls, if you look at what the Chinese have by way of these agreements with various small island countries and so on, these are R&R agreements, rest and replenishment agreements. In time of peace, in time of war, all this goes out the window. Meaning, none of these countries are in the business or will be in the business of supporting China if there's an India-China conflict, because they cannot afford to alienate India. Most of the island countries we have, they depend on us entirely or to a very great extent for security purposes. And so without that help, without that reassurance that comes to them from Indian subsurface, I think they rely on us, you would have a problem. So I don't think you should blow up the string of pearls. It's all very good on tabletop discussions like this and so on. But in implementing this string of pearls strategy, it'll not at all be easy for the Chinese Navy.
Okay, thank you for that confident note, Bharat. I'm a little surprised to hear that coming from you, but I have actually run into your coffee break time, so I apologize for that. And I have several other questions, but you know, we will have time in the late afternoon session, as well as I'm going to ask my colleague Richard Fontaine, when he for his session, to please bring one question I was not able to ask, but that is the energy security and the Iran question. I decided I didn't want to take up all the exciting questions with China and Pakistan. I'll leave Iran to you then. And I must say that starting off, Ambassador Mansingh, you suggested that there was a great deal of agreement across the board, and I'm afraid, I think I'm happy to say that I disagree with you on that, if the panel is any evidence of that. So please join me in thanking the member for a very vigorous. Hopefully I've warmed them up for the next sessions now. We'll get back here in about 10 minutes.